War meant for most Greeks a daily struggle to survive. The immense privation alongside the ruthlessness of German reprisals for acts of sabotage nourished, as in Yugoslavia, the guerrilla activities of rapidly growing but bitterly divided partisan movements. By 1943, the communist resistance movement, the largest in Europe, was violently opposed by non-communist nationalist republicans, who would eventually gain British backing. The roots of the devastating post-war civil war were firmly embedded. In Italy, too, the collapse of Mussolini's regime in July 1943, followed by the German occupation of the north and the far more benign Allied occupation of the south, created conditions that came close to forming a civil war within the war itself. The fascist regime had merely papered over the deep fissures in Italian society. The war, never hugely popular from the outset, brought growing internal disaffection and collapsing morale. This was accentuated by acute food shortages, accompanied by steeply rising prices and a thriving black market, then by Allied bombing, which, far from unifying the population behind the government, stirred huge anger at the fascist authorities that had exposed people to the air raids. After the Germans had reinstated Mussolini as head of a puppet regime with his headquarters at Salò on Lake Garda in September 1943, the underlying divisions took on sharply radicalized form. Increasingly, desperate followers of Mussolini, many of them hard-line fanatics and idealists, who looked to the possibility of completing the fascist revolution, formed vicious death squads, hanging or shooting partisans or any who got in their way. Meanwhile, the various partisan organizations, frequently settling old scores, assassinated hundreds of fascists each month wherever they found them, as well as engaging in sabotage in the war against the German occupiers. The combination of war and, in effect, civil war, made the months of Mussolini's so-called Salò Republic the most bitter and violent in the entire conflict for Italians in the north of the country. Up to 40,000 partisans are estimated to have been killed in fighting. A further 10,000 anti-fascists fell victim to reprisal killings, and around 12,000 fascists or their collaborators were wiped out in cleansing actions. Anti-fascist resistance, dominated by communists but incorporating fighters of different political colours, could reckon with the support of over a quarter of a million activists by April 1945. Unlike Yugoslavia or Greece, however, they were able to unite against a common enemy in what they saw as a war of national liberation. Mounting insurrection on such a scale against retreating German forces that they controlled many northern towns and cities before the Allies arrived. In the very last days of April, they were able to capture and shoot Mussolini, leaving his corpse to hang in the center of Milan. In the south of the country, meanwhile, Allied occupation from September 1943 onwards had meant that the civil war of the north was avoided. Instead, under the cloak of the first reawakening of pluralist politics following the Allied entry into Rome in June 1944, there was a swift return to the age-old clientelism of southern Italian society. The war had left the north-south divide in Italy as great at the end as it had been at the start. In northern and western Europe, German occupation produced nothing like the conditions of civil war in the south. Compared with eastern and southern Europe, the occupation of these parts of the continent was at least in the early stages of the war relatively mild. Nevertheless, the war meant primarily coming to terms with the realities of life in a conquered country. Invariably, the Germans found cooperation from existing state bureaucracies and from a minority keen to collaborate out of political conviction. Another minority, growing in size as it became clear that the days of German occupation were numbered, entered the perilous world of active resistance. But most people were neither outright collaborators nor resistance fighters. They wanted to see their country liberated, but as there was no knowing how long the occupation was going to last, some manner of adaptation to the new regime in whatever form was unavoidable. How the people of Northwest European countries adjusted shaped not only what the war meant to them, but also had a lasting legacy. The character of the occupation, the prevalent political culture of the occupied country, conditioning in good measure the behaviour of both the elites and the masses, and the change from early, comparatively benign administration to increasing harshness and imposition of intense material hardship on the population, were fundamental in shaping the varied responses to German rule. The Netherlands, Belgium, Norway, and Denmark had differing wartime experiences, though the trajectory of occupation was often relatively similar. The Germans were keen, initially, to keep Western Europe quiet. Cooperation, not rebelliousness, was what they wanted. Military conquest wasn't directed towards turning the subjugated people into helots, as in Eastern Europe, especially since there were vague notions of incorporating the Germanic peoples of the Low Countries and Scandinavia within the Reich in the distant future. In each country, there was a minority of homegrown fascists or national socialists who positively welcomed German rule. The Prime Minister of Norway's puppet government, Vidkun Quisling, even lent his name to the general term Quislings, given by the Western Allies to collaborators. Each of the four countries provided small contingents of fanatics who joined the foreign legions of the Waffen-SS, about 50,000 Dutch and 40,000 Belgians, both Flemings and French-speaking Walloons, 6,000 Danes and 4,000 Norwegians served. Since ideologically committed fully-fledged collaborators were generally detested as traitors by most of the population, they were often seen as largely counterproductive by the occupiers. The willing cooperation of the bureaucracy and police, on the other hand, was essential to the effectiveness of the occupation. After 1942, as it became ever clearer that occupation wasn't going to be indefinite, and as German demands for food, other material provisions, and labour sharply intensified, popular opposition in numerous and various forms greatly increased. There were, nonetheless, substantial differences in the pressure of occupation, even within Western Europe. German rule in Denmark, for instance, was for most of the war far less repressive than in the other occupied parts of Northern and Western Europe. This was mirrored in the relatively low number of lives lost. Danish civilian deaths totaled about 1,100 during the occupation. Denmark had almost immediately surrendered on the invasion in April 1940. King Christian X remained in the country, and the government continued to administer the country under a German governor. The collaboration worked at first. Food rations were better, despite the Danes delivering large quantities of foodstuffs to Germany. Forced labour was never introduced. There was no direct plundering of the country, and occupation costs amounted to only 22% of national income per year, compared with 67% in Norway and 52% in Belgium. From August 1943, however, policy in Denmark changed. This followed a rebellion against collaboration, forcing the resignation of the Danish government. Thereafter, the occupation became harsher, the role of the German police much more assertive, the level of reprisals significantly higher, and both non-cooperation and outright resistance more evident. Cooperation gave way to truculence, which in turn fostered a resistance movement that reached its highest levels of activity in 1944-45. Out of widespread compliance at the beginning, the character of German rule in all northwestern countries ultimately led to implacable disaffection. In the Netherlands, for example, drastic rationing already in 1940 brought severe food shortages, especially for city dwellers, accompanied by soaring prices and a rampant black market, while curfews and transport restrictions reduced public life to a minimum. Law-abiding people were effectively forced into breaking the law to keep warm and fed. The trawl for labour to be coerced into working in Germany for war industries, as the German labour shortage became acute, quickly turned into a further source of mass unrest. In the Netherlands, as elsewhere, only few joined the underground resistance movement. Resistance was an intensely perilous activity, continually subject to betrayal and treachery, creating terrible dangers for families, then to horrendous torture and death for those captured. Those directly involved probably numbered around only 25,000 in the Netherlands before the autumn of 1944, with maybe another 10,000 or so joining thereafter. The attritional rate was high. Over a third of Dutch resistors were arrested. Nearly a quarter didn't survive the war. A somewhat higher proportion of the Norwegian population of around 3 million was actively engaged in resistance. Resistance fighters there, often trained in British exile, sabotaged German shipping, fuel supplies and industrial installations, as well as later railways to prevent troop movements. They built close links with the British SOE, sustaining their activities in part through the Shetland bus, boats shuttling between Bergen and the Shetland Islands. Some 40,000 Norwegians were actively involved in resistance by the end of the war. For acts of sabotage or attacks on members of the occupying forces, entire communities could face ferocious German reprisals. These were indeed terrifying. The small Norwegian fishing village of Tilivag, for instance, was completely destroyed, and its male inhabitants were sent to the concentration camp at Sachsenhausen, near Berlin, where 31 of them died, for shielding resistance fighters who had killed 2 Gestapo agents. Those involved in active resistance within countries under German occupation were united only by the desire to see the end of it, but they were otherwise often sharply divided ideologically between conservative nationalists, socialists, and communists. With all the perils, resistance nonetheless gained broadening networks of support as the war neared its end. The harsher the German occupation became, the more the strength of anti-German feeling served to cement the sense of national unity and the desire for liberation. The suffering of the population from German punitive measures was nevertheless often extreme. When Dutch resistance halted the railways to assist the Allied landing at Arnhem in September 1944, German reprisals by blockading food supplies subjected the whole population to starvation, and an extreme shortage of heating materials in the freezing cold hunger winter of 1944-45. Relief only came through with Allied airdrops in the last days of the war. For the Dutch, the war meant above all the trauma of such suffering in the last months of the conflict. Whatever solidarity occupation engendered among the conquered peoples of Northwest European countries, it rarely extended to the Jewish communities, small in the main by comparison with those of Eastern Europe. Virulent anti-Semitism didn't have to be widespread. Even so, Jews were usually seen as outsiders, all the more so when forced to wear the yellow star. The resolute determination of the German rulers to round them up for deportation, coupled with fears that any help given to Jews might bring harsh recrimination, meant that the section of society facing the gravest danger was also the least protected and most exposed. The non-Jewish population was, however, not wholly passive or hostile. The first attempts to round up Amsterdam Jews for deportation in February 1941 even prompted a short-lived mass strike, though this may have backfired into encouraging greater readiness on the part of Dutch bureaucrats and police to cooperate with the occupiers. Such cooperation, at times even anticipating the presumed wishes of the Germans, helped to ensure that proportionally more Jews, some 107,000 out of 140,000 designated by the Nazis as full Jews, were deported, most of them to their deaths, from the Netherlands than from any other Western European country. There were, however, those prepared to take risks themselves from Christian principles and a variety of other motives to help Jews. About 25,000 Dutch Jews, including half-Jews and those in mixed marriages who had a degree of protection from summary deportation, benefited from such help from individuals or rescue networks in evading capture and disappearing into a precarious underground illegal existence, though 8,000 of these were caught in hiding. Belgian networks for helping Jews to escape the clutches of the occupiers were more extensive, especially the illegal organizations of the Jews themselves. About 24,000 Jews were deported from Belgium to Auschwitz, but a further 30,000, the great majority of them recent immigrants living in Brussels and Antwerp, who had fled poverty and pogroms in Eastern Europe in the 1920s and from Germany during the 1930s, found some form of refuge and managed to survive the occupation. Hundreds of Jews, over half of the small Norwegian Jewish community, were helped to get away to neutral Sweden, though most of those who stayed eventually perished. In Denmark in 1943, non-Jews warned Jewish neighbours, Jews constituted a tiny proportion of the overall population and were well assimilated, of the imminent roundup planned by the German occupiers and helped them escape. As a result, the great majority of the Jews designated for deportation to their deaths were spirited away across the Sound to the safe haven of Sweden. Although Jews had much better chances of survival in Western than Eastern Europe, most still fell victim to the relentless German drive to complete the final solution of the Jewish question. The population of France, by far the biggest of the conquered countries of northwestern Europe, shared some of the experience of their northern neighbours. There were, however, significant differences. Some arose from the division of France into two zones, an occupied zone covering approximately two-thirds of the country, northern France, including Paris, and a strip down the whole of the Atlantic coastline, and an unoccupied, quasi-autonomous zone with its capital in the central French spa town of Vichy. What the war meant to people varied over the duration of the war, and according to geographical location. Not just Vichy or the occupied zone, but even region and locality, as well as ideological predisposition and personal experience. This time, there was no sense of the Union Sacrée that President Poincaré had successfully evoked in 1914. The catastrophe of defeat in the summer of 1940, which saw three-quarters of the panic-stricken population of northern towns fleeing southward from the oncoming German invasion, had left the French people divided and humiliated. Alongside the shock, however, the French right, which, whatever its divisions, was united at least in its detestation of the Third Republic, welcomed defeat as a chance to bring about national rebirth. There were collaborators of the first rank out of ideological conviction, such as the former socialist Marcel Déat, who became Minister of Labour, responsible for conscripting French workers to serve in Germany. And there was the fascist leader Jacques Doriot, who later joined 4,000 other French volunteers to fight in the crusade against Bolshevism on the Eastern Front. One of the most prominent faces of collaboration was that of Pierre Laval, vice premier in the Vichy regime, a skillful pragmatist and political manipulator who publicly declared his wish for a German victory, because otherwise Bolshevism would install itself everywhere. Such overt collaboration was not typical of the mass of the French people, but nor was active resistance, certainly not in the early years of the occupation. Most people, like those in the other occupied countries of Western Europe, had to find ways of accommodating, though seldom enthusiastically, to occupation, cooperating with the new rulers when unavoidable, generally keeping their distance, adopting a stance of wait and see, and displaying mounting detestation as the occupation became harsher and as the prospect of liberation loomed larger. As elsewhere in northwestern Europe, German occupation was at first relatively mild, but it became more draconian as Germany started to face adversity. The economic demands on France were heavy. 55% of French government revenue to cover occupation costs, 40% of France's total industrial output to go towards the German war effort, 15% of its agricultural produce to assist in keeping food on German tables, and, by 1943, 600,000 men drafted for work in Germany. Most French families in cities and towns, like those in other parts of northwestern Europe, experienced the war as a constant struggle to obtain food, often via the black market. French experience of severe privation and material hardship stretched over both zones. But the demarcation line between the zones did have real meaning. In the southern third of France, government was in French, not German, hands. Although bearing the scars of defeat materially and psychologically, the French largely controlled their own destiny in the non-occupied zone. Vichy provided yet another meaning to the war for millions of Frenchmen. Rejection of the Republic, which in many ways had become discredited as corrupt and decadent long before the military defeat of 1940, and a restoration of traditional French values of work, family, country. The French state, as the authoritarian Vichy regime headed by Marshal Pétain after the fall of France called itself, was widely popular at first, though its popularity ebbed sharply after the first year or so. About 1.2 million veterans rushed to join Légion Française des Combattants, an organization with some resemblance to a fascist-style acclamatory body, swearing allegiance to the marshal and forming the base of the flourishing personality cult built up around Pétain. As a representative of patriarchal authority and Christianity, the figurehead of the reaction against atheism, socialism, and secularization, Pétain also enjoyed the backing of the Catholic hierarchy. The octogenarian marshal scarcely embodied the symbolism of youth common to fascist movements. Even so, his regime had fascist traits in its evocation of a mythologized past, its glorification of the countryside and return to the land, its idealization of an organic society, its emphasis on youth, motherhood, and natalist policies to renew the population, and, not least, in its persecution of internal enemies. Even in Vichy's early days, left-wing mayors had been ousted, Freemasons dismissed from all state employment, and trade union organizations dissolved. Dozens of internment camps for foreigners, political prisoners, social undesirables. Roma and Jews were set up. Vichy authorities extended the Aryanization program of the occupied zone to expropriate thousands of Jewish firms, bought for knockdown prices by French companies. The regime introduced anti-Jewish statutes to restrict Jewish employment. In 1942 and afterwards, Vichy bureaucrats and police collaborated avidly in the roundup and brutal deportation of foreign Jews, around a half of France's total Jewish population of 300,000, to add to the deportations from the occupied zone. Of the 75,721 Jews deported from France to the death camps in Poland, of whom only 2,567 survived, foreign Jews comprised 56,000. Non-Jews, too, had to contend with increasing repression. Already by the autumn of 1941, the first assassinations of German personnel resulted in up to 50 hostages executed in reprisal. Other mass reprisal shootings soon followed. The reprisals drastically intensified in number and scale after the Allied landings in June 1944. In the most famous action carried out by the Waffen-SS, the entire village of Oradour-sur-Glane, northwest of Limoges, wrongly assumed to be concealing a cache of arms for the resistance, was laid waste. Its 642 inhabitants were shot or burnt to death. The French black-shirted paramilitary police, the Milice, established in the Vichy zone in 1943, were feared as much as the Gestapo as an agent of repressive terror. However, repression, as elsewhere, became increasingly counterproductive once it became obvious that the days of German rule were numbered. It went a long way towards creating unity where none had earlier been present, unity behind the goal of liberation. Active resistance, itself divided between communist, re-galvanized once Germany had invaded the Soviet Union, and conservative, gradually congealing under de Gaulle's leadership, became more, not less extensive, despite the dread of fearsome retribution if captured. Whereas most French people avoided active participation and still preferred a wait-and-see stance, the levels of support grew for those engaged in resistance. Like almost nothing else, the law introduced on the 16th of February 1943 by the Vichy regime and signed by Prime Minister Laval to enforce compulsory labour in Germany created a climate of popular disobedience that fed into the growth of active resistance. Large numbers of those conscripted simply disappeared, often into the mountains or remote countryside, where they were taken in and sheltered by locals, not infrequently joining the swelling resistance movement as liberation approached after the Allied landings in Normandy in June 1944. After the war, resistance came to symbolize more than anything else what the conflict had meant to the French. This was intended to, and did for long, draw a veil over the less palatable side of the French experience after defeat during the Black Years, especially in the unoccupied zone that they themselves had, at least at first, controlled. It would be many years before the French were ready to confront the Vichy syndrome. For the home front in Germany, the war acquired meanings not shared by the people of any other country. What the American journalist William Shirer, who experienced the war at first hand in Berlin from the outset until the start of hostilities with the USA in December 1941, somewhat cynically noted as the basic reaction to the brief campaign in Poland, had general application until major anxieties started to mount in the autumn of 1941. As long as the Germans are successful, and don't have to pull in their belts too much, this won't be an unpopular war. By the winter of 1941-42, however, despite plundering much of Europe for food and other resources, privations at home had sharply increased, and belt tightening among the civilian population became necessary as food rations were sharply cut. The popularity of the war and the regime that had taken Germany into it declined dramatically. The drastic deterioration in the military situation, symbolized more plainly than anything in February 1943 by the disastrous defeat at Stalingrad, brought the mounting realization among the domestic population that the war could well be lost. This necessitated, in turn, contemplating what a lost war would mean. Propaganda played upon the fears not just of military defeat, but of the entire destruction of Germany and of the German people, should the unholy coalition of the Reich's enemies, the Western Allies, and the dreaded Bolsheviks prevail. People were broadly aware, even if they consciously or subconsciously suppressed the knowledge in a conspiracy of silence, that Germans had perpetrated terrible crimes in the occupied East, especially against Jews. Although few knew details, there were numerous indications of extensive awareness of the fate of the Jews. Betraying the success of anti-Semitic propaganda, many expressed fear of Jewish revenge in the event of defeat. They also knew they could expect no mercy if the Red Army entered Germany. Dread of the consequences of defeat did much to sustain the readiness of the population to hold out, despite the rapidly worsening military situation. The last 2 years of the war saw the horror that the Nazis had inflicted on most of Europe rebound upon ordinary Germans themselves. For the German civilian population, the last phase of the conflict was their hell on earth. What characterized the trauma for millions was fear of Allied bombs. Goebbels called it terror bombing. In this case, propaganda didn't lie. The bombing was meant to terrorize the population, and did so, as people were left defenseless while their towns and cities were obliterated. More than 400,000 people were killed and 800,000 injured by bombing raids on towns and cities, attacks that were increasingly pointless from a military perspective. Around 1.8 million homes were destroyed, nearly 5 million people left homeless. The civilian population of Germany's eastern provinces, less exposed to the bombing, faced a different sort of terror. People had to flee from their homes in icy conditions, in temperatures of minus 20 degrees Celsius, to join the flood of refugees pouring westwards, in fear and dread, as the Red Army drove into the Reich. Close on 500,000 civilians, many women and children, died in the desperate flight from the doomed German East. For many German women in the path of the Red Army, the last phase of the war meant violence against their bodies, as an estimated 20% of them were raped by Soviet soldiers. More than 10,000 German soldiers were meanwhile being killed on average every day in the last months of the war. As the death toll of civilians as well as soldiers rose astronomically, the war acquired new meaning for Germans. They saw themselves as victims of the conflict. They blamed Hitler and the Nazi leadership for inflicting the catastrophe on Germany, the Allies for the devastation of their country, and yet again, this among a minority core of recalcitrant anti-Semites, even the Jews for bringing about the war. "We believe ourselves to have been fooled, led astray, misused," a former general put it soon after the war, expressing a common sentiment. In the search for scapegoats and the perception of themselves as victims, traumatized people often overlooked the fact that they had in their millions cheered Hitler's earlier successes and rejoiced in the victories of the Wehrmacht, even as countless Europeans suffered penury and slavery, death and destruction under the Nazi yoke. But if the full dimensions of the moral catastrophe would take years to gain recognition, at least this time, compared with 1918, the defeat was total, unmitigated, and final. Lasting meaning. For those who lived through this hell on earth, the immediacy of their experience in its varied manifestations shaped what the war meant to them. Later generations can see the lasting significance of the war somewhat more clearly, can see more plainly that it marked the decisive caesura in the history of the 20th century in Europe. The definitive ending of fascism as a major political force was one obvious consequence. Out of the First World War had emerged a triad of competing ideologies and constellations of power: liberal democracy, communism, and fascism. After the Second World War, only the first two were left as rival political systems. Total military defeat and the increasing revelation of fascism's unprecedented crimes against humanity now discredited that ideology completely, other than in the eyes of dwindling and politically largely impotent admirers. An overriding consequence of the Second World War was the recasting of Europe's geopolitical structure. The First World War had ended with Russia, soon to become the Soviet Union, convulsed by revolution, then civil war, and the United States distancing itself from Europe through its unwillingness to join the League of Nations and its shift to isolationism. The Second World War ended with the boundaries of Soviet influence largely decided at the Yalta Conference in February 1945, greatly extended throughout Eastern Europe, even into Germany itself. On the back of its military victory, the Soviet Union was now well on the way to becoming a superpower. The United States, which the war had already forged into a superpower on the basis of its mighty military-industrial complex, itself a product of the conflict, had established its own dominance throughout Western Europe and, unlike 1918, was destined to stay on the European continent in the long term. Whereas the First World War had broken empires and replaced them with crisis-ridden nation-states, the Second World War produced a Europe divided down the middle between the two blocs dominated by the USSR and the USA, in which national interests were swiftly becoming subordinated to the geopolitical concerns of the emerging superpowers. For the peoples of Eastern Europe, those who had suffered most in the six-year conflagration, the war came to mean the replacement of one tyranny by another. The countries of the East, which had seen the Red Army as their savior from Nazi terror, now fell under decades-long Soviet oppression. Stalin wasn't going to give up his gains, made through the shedding of so much blood. That was plain. The Western Allies agreed to his new division of Europe, short of turning on their former ally and fighting another war which they were not military, economically, or psychologically capable of doing, they had little choice. For the peoples of Eastern Europe, that was cold comfort. For Western Europe, the war brought a new start, one that was difficult to discern peering through the ruins of 1945, even as the bombs wrought their destruction. Planning was underway for the rebuilding of Europe and avoiding the mistakes that had bedeviled the continent after 1918. While Eastern Europe battened down under Soviet domination and state-run socialist economies, the rebuilding of Western Europe reinvigorated capitalist enterprise. In economics as well as politics, the war had divided Europe. The reordering of Europe also saw the fundamental weakening of the three one-time great powers, Britain, France, and Germany, which had previously dominated the continent. Britain had been bankrupted by the war, its status as a great power massively eroded. Its empire had backed it in the war, but the peoples of the colonies, perceiving imperial weakness, increasingly looked to their independence. The already shaky foundations of colonial rule were now undermined more than ever. France had suffered an enormous blow to its national pride through the defeat of 1940, a blow by no means compensated by the much emblazoned courage of the resistance. French colonies, too, were eyeing independence. No longer prepared to contemplate an indefinite future of rule from Paris. Germany, defeated but not destroyed in 1918, and carrying simmering resentments that later paved the way for Hitler's rise to power, was this time utterly crushed. Divided into the four zones of occupation agreed at Yalta, British, American, Soviet, and, a late addition, French, Germany was a completely ruined country, economically as well as politically destroyed, its sovereignty as a nation eliminated. This marked the end of the German question that had preoccupied European politicians since the days of Bismarck. In the aftermath of defeat, the state of Prussia, the dominant force in the Reich, was dissolved. The German armed forces were disbanded, thus ending any threat of German militarism, and the industrial base that had provided the economic framework for Germany's dominance was placed under Allied control. The big landed estates in the eastern provinces of Germany, the homelands of so much of the German aristocracy that had played a major part in the army and the state for so long, were lost in perpetuity as the frontiers were shifted westward. Once internationally admired for its culture and learning, Germany was morally now reduced to pariah status. Though the reckoning with the German leadership was still to come in the war crimes trials that the victorious Allies were soon to stage. It would take many years before the immensity of the collapse of civilization would come to be fully recognized, would take its due central place in the understanding of the Second World War's legacy. German genocidal policy had reshaped much of the ethnic pattern of settlement, especially in Eastern Europe. The destruction of the Jews, in particular, had wiped out centuries of a rich cultural presence. Ethnic cleansing actions by Germans and by their allies had also had a lasting impact, and sometimes left a legacy of grievance, as in Yugoslavia, that decades of communist rule wouldn't efface. The ethnic German presence, too, in Eastern Europe was eliminated both by Stalinist brutality and then by the savage cleansing actions by Poles, Czechs, Hungarians, and Romanians in the immediate post-war years. Above all, however, the collapse of civilization was denoted by the German attempt to destroy physically the Jews of Europe on grounds of race alone. That this vast war had a racial project, one of genocidal destruction, at its very heart, would come over time to be seen as its defining feature. The moral question of how this conflagration could have been possible, how Europe could have plunged into this bottomless pit of inhumanity, would preoccupy the continent for generations. War had revealed more plainly than ever before the terrible crimes of which human beings are capable, when all legal constraints on behavior are removed or warped to serve inhumane purposes. The concentration camp came to symbolize more than anything else the nightmare of a world in which human existence counted for nothing, in which arbitrary will determined life or death. Increasingly, it became clear that in creating this hell on earth for so many of its citizens, Europe had come close to destroying itself. The realization that the continent had been on a suicidal path meant there was the need for an entirely new start. Although the European War ended with the German capitulation On the 8th of May 1945, VE Day, European troops were still fighting in the Far East for another 3 months, until the Japanese too surrendered unconditionally. The total defeat of the Japanese brought the world conflict to an end. This was hastened by the event that more than any other would shape Europe's future, and that of the rest of the world, in the coming decades. The dropping of the atom bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on the 6th of August, followed 3 days later by a similar devastating attack on Nagasaki. The Americans had for 4 years been pouring huge resources, as well as employing the pioneering research of nuclear scientists into producing the atom bomb. The Germans, mercifully, had lagged far behind in their own research. The dropping of the atom bomb at once dramatically changed the basis of political and military power, and refashioned the ways in which war could be conceived. It would be impossible in the future to fight a war through attritional mass slaughter, as at the Somme in the First World War, or as at Stalingrad in the Second. But a future war in Europe would mean destruction on a scale not remotely reached even in the Second World War. The atom bomb now gave its possessors a terrible weapon, one that, as nuclear weaponry became even more devastating, would have the power to destroy an entire country at the push of a button. The ultimate legacy of the war was to leave Europe and the rest of the world under the permanent threat of weapons of unprecedented destruction. From now on, Europeans would have to learn to live under the shadow of the bomb, to face the threat of nuclear annihilation. The bomb's mushroom cloud would be the symbol of a new age. It was the point when the world turned. Chapter 9. Quiet Transitions in the Dark Decades. Mark Sloker, Essays from the Nick of Time, Reflections and Refutations. History resists an ending as surely as nature abhors a vacuum. The narrative of our days is a run-on sentence, every full stop a comma in embryo. The 30 years in which Europe seemed bent on self-destruction were so disastrous and characterized by such massive ruptures that continuities of long-term socio-economic value systems and cultural trends of development seem scarcely conceivable. Yet, beneath the surface of Europe's dark age, people's lives did continue to be shaped or reshaped in quiet transitions, unbroken if not untouched by the trauma. Beyond the impersonal long-term determinants of social and economic change lay the values and beliefs by which people led their lives, predominantly the preserve still of the Christian churches. A good deal of the most important political and social thought of the era nevertheless stood outside or even in opposition to the influence of the churches. How did Europe's intellectual elite respond to what they perceived to be a crisis of civilization? When work, reflection, and sometimes prayer were done, a fourth sphere was left. Leisure and enjoyment to be had from the rapidly changing field of popular entertainment. Each of these four areas, economic and social change, the role of the Christian churches, the reaction of intellectuals, and the culture industry, reveals both continuities and transitions that would leave a significant mark on the post-war world. Economy and society, dynamics of change. Throughout all the horrors that afflicted Europe between 1914 and 1945, the economies and societies of European countries were in fact growing somewhat more like each other. Of course, major differences, especially national, ethnic, regional, and often interspersed with these, religious, remained. These were above all what shaped a sense of identity, even more so than social class. Opportunities for foreign travel, apart from for the upper classes and leaving aside service in the military, were extremely limited, enhancing the sense of national identity and the prejudices that often accompanied it. The fragmentation after the First World War into a continent even more dominated than before by nation-states, often driven by extreme nationalism, and the establishment, most notably in Russia, Italy, and Germany, of systems of rule with quite different and incompatible economic models, tended to drive countries apart rather than closer together. The two world wars, it goes without saying, produced their own distortions and divergences. Yet there were important underlying patterns of development that transcended, or at best were only temporarily interrupted by, political distinctiveness and division. The long-term impact of industrialization, affecting different parts of Europe in varying degrees and at dissimilar tempos, was the determining dynamic force. The ensuing changes affected practically the entire continent and weren't confined by national boundaries. Even the least developed countries were touched in some ways, importing, copying, or assimilating change that was already underway elsewhere. The gap between the wealthier, economically more advanced parts of Western and Northern Europe and the poorer South and East barely diminished over the first half of the 20th century. Even so, the trends in development, in demography, urbanization, industrialization, employment patterns, social security, literacy, and social mobility were broadly similar. Population. Despite two world wars, numerous civil conflicts, politically induced major famines, economic depression, and large-scale ethnic cleansing, Europe's population continued to grow substantially during the first half of the 20th century, if less rapidly than during the preceding half-century. In 1913, almost 500 million people lived in Europe. By 1950, this figure had reached almost 600 million. The growth was, of course, not uniform. Political and military factors obviously exerted their influence in some parts of the continent. The Soviet population was 26 million smaller in 1946 than it had been in 1941. German population statistics also plainly show the damaging impact of both world wars and also of the Great Depression of the 1930s. In both countries, however, the drop in population proved temporary, even if for years women greatly outnumbered men. Economic backwardness also played its part in demographic patterns. The Irish population, for instance, dropped as large numbers of young people left their homeland for work, mainly in Britain. The general population trend was nevertheless upwards. The main cause was a steep decline in death rates, continuing a trend that had begun in the second half of the 19th century, but accelerated sharply in the first half of the 20th. Birth rates were also declining, but at a far slower pace than death rates. In 1910, life expectancy at birth in northwestern Europe was around 55 years, in Russia about 37 years, and in Turkey under 35 years. 40 years later, most people across the continent could expect to live to the age of 65 or more. At the start of the century, the highest birth and mortality rates were to be found in Eastern and Southern Europe. By 1950, the gap with Northern and Western Europe had narrowed considerably. Even in Russia, despite the horrors the country was forced to endure, the mortality rate dropped remarkably, from 28 per 1,000 head of population under the Tsar to 11 per 1,000 in 1948. The fall in the mortality rate was largely the result of the greater emphasis attached to public hygiene, better housing, health education, and corresponding improvements in the health of mothers, which greatly assisted the decline in child mortality. Generally, if at different rates largely related to levels of economic advancement, European countries experienced greatly improved health over the first half of the 20th century. The big housing boom of the 1920s, referred to in Chapter 4, often sponsored by government spending, reduced some of the most squalid overcrowding and brought improvements in sewerage, water supplies, and personal hygiene. Modestly increasing real income and better diet, as the ratio of meat to cereal consumed rose, also contributed to the fall in mortality. Awareness of the importance of public health spread from the relatively advanced countries of northwestern Europe to the east and south of the continent. But where little was done to overcome the backwardness of poor sanitation, deficient personal hygiene and lack of medical facilities, as in Albania, Macedonia, southern Italy and Turkey, mortality rates remained disproportionately high. Advances in medical knowledge and care contributed to falling mortality rates by greatly reducing the chances of premature death through infectious diseases. The medical advances were less in surgical techniques, though reconstructive surgery had made some headway in the First World War, than in treatment of wounds and development of medicines to combat killer diseases, such as tuberculosis and influenza. The influenza epidemic at the end of the First World War had led to far more deaths than the military carnage itself. Infants had been especially prone to enteric diseases, and birth-related child mortality had remained high. But sulfonamides started to be used increasingly to control infectious diseases, while immunization against tetanus and diphtheria, antimalarial drugs and penicillin, initially developed to prevent wound infection, became available, though only to the Western Allies, towards the end of the Second World War. But sulfonamides started to be used increasingly to control infectious diseases, as were immunization against tetanus and diphtheria and antimalarial drugs. Penicillin, initially developed to prevent wound infection, became available, though only to the Western Allies, towards the end of the Second World War. But even here, infectious diseases were coming under control. Cases of malaria, for instance, fell in Italy from 234,000 in 1922 to under 50,000 by 1945, and by 1950, the disease had been almost totally eliminated. The poorer, less developed parts of the continent also continued to flout the general trend towards declining fertility. In Russia, Spain, and Portugal, the decline only began in the 1920s, in southern Italy and Turkey, even after the Second World War. In Turkey, between the wars, the fertility level was over 5 births per mother. In most of Europe, it had fallen by then to about 2.5 births per mother, and in some countries to under 2, or less than the rate necessary to reproduce the population, short of immigration. This prompted great anxiety about falling birth rates and national decline, especially in France, where the low rate had set in early, the Scandinavian countries, and, not least, playing into fascist ideology in Italy and Germany. The spread of birth control and greater education in family planning, itself helped by increasing literacy, played a big part in the declining fertility. In Western Europe, around 90% of births fell within marriage. Illegitimacy still carried a social stigma, and marriage rates remained fairly stable, apart from a short-lived boom in the late 1930s. So the decisive factor was that couples were simply choosing to have fewer children, a trend encouraged by the greater numbers of younger women entering paid employment. Catholic regions of Europe and the poorer rural areas of Eastern and Southern Europe only gradually fell into line with the general pattern of declining fertility. In Western Europe, the relative size of the rural population of Ireland was an exception to the general trend, though the direction was the same and the speed of convergence tended to increase alongside greater levels of modernization of the economy.